This is tape number 3 of an interview with Dr. Clinton N. Woolsey, Professor Emeritus of Neurophysiology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This portion of the interview was conducted in Dr. Woolsey's office at the Weissman Center on February 18, 1982, by Calvin Pierce.
Okay.
So then I went to work with Bard in physiology, again with the notion that as he said, if you want to be a neurosurgeon, you need to know something about the nervous system. And I worked at that for about 4 years, continuing to practice my surgical techniques. And it wasn't until the end of the fourth year that I finally realized that I really wasn't going to go into neurosurgery.
Did you ever have any regrets for not becoming a practitioner?
No. Been a lot more fun, I think. And as you see with all these individuals here that I have marked with crosses, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 of 6 of whom turned into neurosurgeons. Hmm. I think it's a tough life, probably.
4 of the 6
that I have died. So 4 of 6 of the dead, 2 of the dead, one was a physiologist, the other, he was a physiologist too, 2 were physiologists and 4 of the 6 who died were neurosurgeons.
Let me ask you, while you were in the later years at Baltimore, were you involved at all in any of the administrative aspects of running the department or helping with any of that?
No, that was not a very difficult job at Hopkins. I don't know whether it's more so now, but Bard was very non-demanding. You didn't have a lot of detail work to perform. You did your research, you did your teaching, and that was the job you had. And so there was little in the way of administrative functions. It wasn't until we began to get grants from the NIH that we had to keep records of how we spent our money, for example.
And one more question about you and Dr. Rose. What was it like working with him on a typical experiment? Who did what, and how did you decide what you were going to do, and how did you go about doing it?
Well, the collaborations that Dr. Rose and I had were mainly in terms of, or on problems that, in which I made the lesions. We discussed what it was we wanted to do. For example, in the study on the thalamocortical relations in the case of the rabbit, the general idea was to place the lesions according to the map which his uncle had made on the basis of the structure of the brain, of the cortex. And we had general diagrams of the brain. Thank you, Alan. We had general diagrams of the brain, and Dr. Rose would be with me at the operation. We'd decide where we wanted to place the lesion in this particular animal, and then later he would, of course, get the brain, check it, see whether we'd made the lesion in the place we intended to, and then he would study the preparation and work up the results. So much of the result of the work that we did together in Baltimore was of that kind. In other words, I was making the lesions in the brain by this suction technique, and he was the anatomist, and he was studying them.
Yeah. Is it a common problem? You've told me before that you collect so much data that it often takes years to work it up and get it published. Is that a common problem in this field?
I think it's... I've talked with many people recently when I began to work up some of the things that we haven't worked up in the past, and they said, well, you come to my lab, I can show you a lot of stuff we haven't published, too. What we usually did was to get it reported at a meeting. It would be discussed, and many things got heard about, but then they didn't get out, and there stood still a good many that are not out. Yeah.
That's interesting. It would have been that word of mouth, in part, that would...
We had that sort of communication, that's mm-hmm. right.
The other thing I was wondering about was the fact that some of these people went into medical practice and surgery, and what connections you might have developed in those years with medical community. You mentioned that you had lectured in Montreal, and
that I just happened to go over that. It was the first year I was here in Wisconsin. No, 47, the year before I came here.
Hmm.
We lectured in Montreal the first time, and we've been there two or three times. I think that I don't remember whether we did we discuss when we were talking about that the two of the events which happened. I think I talked with you about it on the bus,
right?
And so it's not on the record. But the subject of my first lecture in Montreal had to do with the cortical organization of cortical sensory motor areas, particularly sensory, I believe. And in the course of my lecture, I mentioned the fact that in the monkey we had found a second somatosensory area on the upper bank of the Sylvian fissure. And Penfield obviously was quite interested in this, and when I completed my lecture, he got up to make some comments and asked and said that he had himself stimulated that region of the brain, of human brain, and had recorded movements from it, which or sensations which were related to, referred by the patient to the leg. And since the leg area is high up on the hemisphere in the postcentral and precentral cortices, he said that they decided that the current must have been much too strong and was reaching the internal capsule, the fibers which come originate up here. And so when I gave the information on the evoked potential aspects, which of course couldn't be interpreted that way, he thought they should look again. And so within the first year after that, they came out with a paper in which they had confirm the presence of arm and leg representation in this region, separate from the representation in the along the central sulcus.
They confirmed it in humans?
That was in humans, yes, in humans. And then the following morning I went rounds with them, and they had a patient who had been in for epileptic seizures, and in the course of preparing the surgery or deciding where to make the lesion in the cortex or where the epileptic focus was, they had done electrical stimulation of the motor and the sensory areas. And in the course of this, they had stimulated the postcentral gyrus quite high up near the trunk area, and much to their surprise found that the patient reported a sensation on the side of the face, just ahead of the ear.
Mm.
And this was not a place where they expected to get such a response. And they returned to it again and again during the course of the operation, only to have the patient give the same report each time. And that they'd just done the day before, or a day or so before, and they said, "Have you any explanation for that?" Well, we did have an explanation for it based on the studies we had done on the macaque monkey, which had been published, but they obviously hadn't seen them. And I explained that there was an area in that part of the brain which in the monkey had was particularly related to the occipital aspect of the head, but could involve the face as well. And that we had also found the same area in the chimpanzee in the same locus. So the next homunculus they made for man included this occipital aspect of the head attached to the neck up there at the trunk area. So those were two concrete examples of an influence of the laboratory's work upon the clinic. I think the work on the superior bank of Sylvian fissure led them to be able to make diagnoses of epileptic foci there. That was difficult to do from the surface of the head because the cortex was buried, but once they knew that this area was there, they then began to search for it more particularly when they opened the skull and could insert electrodes into the region. So that became an addition to their technique for treating epileptic patients.
Dr. Mountcastle mentioned at some point in something I read that I think it was at a meeting of the Physiological Society around the same time that there was apparently quite a bit of clamor to see some slides of your maps of the cortex and almost didn't get shown at this conference. Do you remember?
Well, I think that's a story. I don't recall that actually in fact happened. There may have been some, I may have gone overrun the time. You see, there were 10 minutes was allowed for giving presenting a paper at the Physiological Society. And if you went over the time, well, the chairman was supposed to stop you, you see. I may have gone over a bit, and that may have been the response of the audience. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't remember it at all. I do know that he said that, but I'd be interested to know where you found that, because I don't remember.
I vaguely remember it being in the retirement ceremony for Dr. Rose, but it could have been.
Oh, it may have been there. Could have been, yeah.
It might have been that.
Might have been there. Could we interrupt just a second?
Sure, Well, let's see. Why did you come to Madison, and who brought you here?
Well, I think that maybe one of the factors that led to my being invited to come to Madison was that at the meeting of the Federation meeting in Chicago, just the preceding year, Federation meeting. Let me find the date here. Turn that off for a second.
This is the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology.
Yes, and they had their annual meeting in Chicago in 1947. And someone had organized a symposium on the cerebral cortex, and I was asked to be one of the speakers. And the topic I chose was patterns of sensory representation in the cerebral cortex. The whole symposium was on functional organization of the cerebral cortex. And I believe that Dr. Meek, who was the professor of physiology here at that time, was present. He was interested in nervous system, and especially as a teacher. He had to teach about the nervous system. And he was also on the committee which had been appointed, I believe, to search for candidates for this new professorship that they were establishing at the 100th anniversary of the university. There were two professorships established on the centennial of the university. One was Frederick Jackson Turner professorship of history, which had been already given to Merle Curti, C-U-R-T-I, who's still with us. And they then decided, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation put up money for a second named professorship. Those were the first two named professorships on the campus here, I believe. And so they had a committee made up of people from various parts of the university, and they finally decided, I don't know the details of that went on there, of course, but they finally decided that they ought to try to recruit somebody who could help develop studies on the nervous system. And so finally they invited me to come out and to be interviewed and look over the place and be looked over. And they did offer the job to me.
It was Dean Middleton at the time?
Middleton was dean of the medical school, that's right, but the committee was a graduate school committee. And the position which was established was, while my assignment was of space was in the medical school, and I was, of course, on the medical faculty in the Department of Physiology, the funding of the professorship was through the graduate school. And I remained, it continued that way for the 30 years or so that I held that, received pay through that mechanism.
Hmm. And you think then Dr. Meek may have suggested interviewing you as one of the...
I think he may have because of that, because somehow or other I recall that he mentioned having heard that symposium, and I don't know whether that was the reason or not.
There's another name associated with this I picked up somewhere, Bowers, was he?
No, he's not related to that. No, that came later.
Hmm. What was he involved with?
Well, he became dean here sometime after Middleton retired, and we can return to him because I was on the committee which gave five names to President Fred, and his name was one of them.
Yeah, I'll ask you about that. Well, what did you expect to gain by coming to Madison? What were the advantages?
Well, I wasn't too sure about that. In fact, I don't know whether I would have been overly enthusiastic about changing positions, except that I talked it over with Bard, and he thought that as one went on in one's career, one ought to respond to opportunities to expand things. And what they told me they wanted me to do, I also reported to Bard, namely that they wanted research on the nervous system developed, and that this should be done through graduate education and postdoctoral training, and that I was not to be involved with the teaching of the medical students.
Mm.
The most that I ever got involved with the medical students was occasionally give a lecture on my some specialty that we were interested in, and that wasn't told me until I got here. I was a little surprised to find that I wouldn't have a direct contact with the medical students, as because it was at Hopkins where I had direct contact with the medical students. That's where we managed to influence students to come to work in the laboratory and get interested in the brain. And so I was a bit disappointed in that, but they did put the money at our disposal to establish a laboratory and get going, and we got going, so I think it worked out very well.
The facilities then were pretty good from the start.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think Dr. Bard was rather disappointed when he finally came and visited me and saw what mediocre space and equipment we did have. But I'd been told by the dean that when we got new, they were expecting to enlarge the medical school, and that one of the priorities would be to provide space for the development of the neuroscience program. And so it was when the man you mentioned, what was his name?
Bowers.
When Bowers was dean, that the money did come through for the building of the medical sciences building. And I remembered the promise of the first dean and went to see Bowers to see whether it was going to be fulfilled under his administration? He said it certainly was. Hmm. And so we had a chance to design the way, the layout for the neurophysiology section of the medical sciences building.
You didn't move in there, though, until
quite... By 1960.
Yeah,
that was 12 years later.
Hmm. When you came to Madison, did you expect that Dr. Rose would be coming here later?
I did. I expected him to come when I came, because one of the things that I had requested when before I said yes that I would take the job was that we needed, I need a neuroanatomist, because research on the nervous system is not only electrophysiology and my field, but I said it's very important to have the anatomy of the systems related to the physiological findings. And I said we had already been doing that with Dr. Rose, and I wondered what the possibilities were of inviting him to come with me, and he agreed that I could. And
this was Dean Middleton.
Middleton, yes, this was Dean Middleton. And he would be given an appointment, joint appointment. Half of his time would be devoted to research, and the other half to teaching in the medical school, Department of Physiology. Well, he was interested in it, but then his first wife was offered the position as chairman of the Department of Psychology at Goucher College, which is in Baltimore. And that she had been living up in and teaching at Smith College in Massachusetts, while Jersey had worked in Baltimore. So that was a much better arrangement. And so he said he couldn't come. So we then searched for other people.
How did the move away from Baltimore and starting up here affect the kind of research you were doing? Did it have any changes there?
Well, we first had to establish facilities for carrying on electrophysiological research, and that could have been done in two ways. One, we could buy the equipment already made. There were companies which were making electrophysiological equipment. But Dean Middleton thought that since we already had on the campus Warren Gilson, who now heads the Gilson Medical Electronics manufacturing out in Middleton, that it would be a good idea to get him to build the equipment, and then we could always rely upon him to take care of it. And I thought that was a splendid idea, and so this was agreed upon. But it took about 2 years to get the equipment built and established in the laboratory. So that there was a change temporarily in what we were doing, from doing electrophysiological studies to returning to something that we'd started once before but never had completed, namely the stimulation of the motor cortex and mapping the cortical areas for movement, because the details with which the sensory maps had been made indicated that earlier studies on cortical stimulation had never been as detailed as that, and so we were interested to know whether the motor map would be in detail, as much detail as the sensory map. And so that we spent the first two years here then working on that. One that only took a $25 instrument.
Hmm.
It built us a 60 cycle stimulator, and we used it in the top floor of the old science building, the red building on at the end of Langdon Street there, up in the church steeple, you might say, at the top.
Hmm.
And the fellow we did that with at that time was Paul Settlich, who was newly received his PhD from psychology, but was beginning as a research assistant, I guess they called it, in the anatomy department. He wanted to become an anatomist.
Hmm.
So he had a stimulator that he had bought. We first used that, and then I had the kind that I liked better, made by the Dr. Gilson, and we continued using that device.
Who else were you working with in those early years here in Wisconsin?
Well, for example, Teresa Pinto came out almost immediately from Baltimore, where she had been, and we had started work there on the motor cortex of the dog. And so she came out and worked with Harry Harlow and with me on a series of experiments we were carrying out on monkeys with relational techniques. I had a graduate student by the name of Anne Marie Travis, who was working here. She was the first one. She ultimately took her medical degree and then went into neurology and psychiatry, but became a great disappointment in that she did a beautiful job as a research worker. She had herself had a cerebral palsy from a child, and yet she was doing beautifully in university, and she got her PhD when she was 23. For work she did with us.
You were working with decorticated animals?
We went so far as to totally decorticate the two monkeys, I think. And but she became, when she got into the clinical area, I think the stress must have been very severe, and she became mentally disturbed. And I don't think that she's been able to carry on since.
You have very many memories of Professor Harlow?
Sure. We worked together, and we organized a symposium together, and there was very close relationships in those days between the psychologists and the developing group of neurophysiology. They'd send people over to work with us, and some of ours, like Teresa Pinto, went to work with them. And so there, that was much closer then than it is now, probably because, first of all, the area of interest in the Primate Center has shifted from learning, and it's gone to in the direction of the neural control of reproduction and things of that sort. And then I think the newer people in psychology have interests in different areas that don't quite so clearly fit in with the neuroscience that we do now. But then I think maybe the group has gotten to be so big, you see, that there's less. See, we used to meet regularly once a month for presentation of at least three papers and for an evening meeting. And this was an organization which was called the Sherrington Society. We began to meet before any name was given to it. And then it was decided that it ought to have a name, and the question was, what name could be given to a group made up of such diverse interests as anatomy, physiology, psychology, neurosurgery, neurology, psychiatry? What kind of a name could you give that organization? Neuroscience wouldn't be might not have been then acceptable, and so Dr. Brogdon, who was in psychology, said, well, why don't we call it the Sherrington Society? And when I talked to Dr. Erickson in neurosurgery, without having heard the suggestion from Brogdon, he also said, why not call it the Sherrington Society? And I said, well, I can't very well object to that. He was a neurophysiologist, so we'll call it the Sherrington Society. So we had a Sherrington lecturer for 10 years, And some of the outstanding people in neuroscience from out the world came to lecture under that. I don't really know why it ceased to exist, but I think one of the reasons was that the group of people became so large that they didn't seem to have the same interest in getting together. I don't know why this should be.
Let me turn over this.
This is side B of tape number 3 of an interview with Dr. Clinton Ann Woolsey, conducted on February 18th, 1982.
Well, one thing I was going to ask was the funding of research on the campus. I guess after World War II, there was quite a growth of federal funding for research.
Well, of course, we had the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. You know that the fact that ultraviolet light will increase the vitamin B content, content was discovered by one of our biochemists. I know his name, but I can't get it out at the moment. And he recognized that immediately this would be taken up by the manufacturing companies to increase the value of their foods. And so he persuaded, they got a committee established, and they decided to establish the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, which would then provide, obtain patents on any discoveries that might have a commercial advantage, and that's how that began. And so there was, by the time I had arrived, you see, there was enough money in it that they could provide my annual salary, and they kept doing that for quite a number of years. And there was also a good deal of money that was from that source, which was available to apply for on the part of research workers on the campus. They used it to provide supplies, animals, student assistance to help in the research. I served for 10 years on that committee, research committee, so we had a chance to see how that operated pretty well. And Elvium was dean of the graduate school at the time I was on that committee, at least when I, up until, I don't know whether he was on at the time I began, but he was when I ended. So that was a source of money, and it was a very, I think we had pretty liberal support for the times. And then, of course, the NIH monies did, had become available. When I came to Wisconsin, we were working on a grant with Dr. Bard, which I think was certainly, I think it was something like B19, something like that, a small number. And I don't recall what our first grant number was here, but it wasn't too big either. And so we had support from the NIH throughout the period that I was active in neurophysiology, in neurophysiological research.
You didn't have any direct involvement then in the medical school issues because, as you say, you were funded by the graduate school.
Well, I think I served once on the medical school committee, research committee. I didn't stay there very long, I'm sure, but maybe a couple of years. And we often got involved with one kind of a committee or another. I was on the committee, there was a seven-member committee, which was appointed by President Fred to bring in names for the possible deans of the medical school, and Bowers was one of the names which we gave him. He then made the decision as to which of the five to invite. And I think it's unfortunate that Bowers didn't work out so well as a dean as he... I think the problem was in part with the medical faculty, which wanted to move in certain directions, and they seemed to Bowers and others that might be more advantageous for the future of the medical school to move in a slightly different direction.
Which directions?
I don't know that. But some of the surgeons were quite opposed to him, and I think they were very powerful positions. So.
Well, I guess you may. How many graduate students were you directly working with in the 50s?
Well, maybe we'd better count those up someday and give you the actual.
We'll come back to that.
We had more postdoctorals than we had graduate students.
Were there very many from foreign countries?
Well, let's see. There was one from Switzerland, Ken Ockert. Hirsch was from Paris. Coletti was from Italy. Hekmat Panah had come from Iran or some such place. Isamat was from Spain. Campos was from Brazil. Chilesia was from Italy. Tasker was from Canada. Guillory is from England. Vallejo is from Bogota, Colombia. Hugo Adrian was from Chile. Mariyama was from Japan. Lipschitz was from Chile. Tanvika Sundaram came here from Central Africa, and he returned now to Sri Lanka, where he originally was born. Adolfo Ley came from Spain. Narkevich came from Poland. Arul Gosami came from Kuala Lumpur, and Victor Vicente Montero came from Chile. Now those Chilean names are, in addition to Pinto that I mentioned before, are numerous because we developed while I was on the NIH committees, there was a new program established that I heard about that was going to provide support, research support, so that a laboratory in this country could develop relationships with a laboratory in some other country. And we'd had our connections with Chile, and we looked into the possibility of developing such a connection, and it turned out to be possible. We had that program began in 1962, and I think it ended in 1980. We had joint programs with them throughout that period of time. And as a result, quite a number of Chileans came. There are two or three others that I didn't mention. There were two electronics technicians. There were graduate students in electrical engineering. So that's the reason why we had so many from that part of the world.
And the research, of course, centered around the motor cortex.
Well, it centered around this, of course, by this time, I'm talking now about a period where, in addition to myself, there were other people were here, even before Jersey Rose came in 1960. We had enlarged the group working in the nervous system to include Joe Hind, who's now chairman, Wally Welker, and Bob Benjamin, who are all still here. And the general tendency at the time was to work in groups, because some of the projects, whether they be stimulating the cortex or mapping the cortex, did require, the experiment was more valuable, the more data you could get and the more extensive the coverage. And one way of doing that is to keep the experiment going around the clock.
Hmm.
That may not be as nice an idea to some as to others, but once you get involved with it, you don't want to quit, you see. And so most of these people would work, and so we had groups. And I could be involved with several people, and they might have their own projects that they'd get started, so they get off on their own feet independently, ultimately. And so that's one of the reasons why many of these people that came did, in fact, work with us, as not just with someone else, like with Welker or Benjamin. Or as soon as the research became highly technical in the realm of auditory system, then of course Joe Hind was the one to whom most people came, and right now that is the area which is best developed at the present time on the campus, although Welker continues to work on in the areas in which we've originally worked, including the cerebellum, and is doing some beautiful work. He examines the cortex, as I mentioned perhaps last time, of the cerebellum with microelectrodes inserted every 100 microseconds, a micro million, micrometers. He'll examine a square millimeter of cortex with 100 punctures. Fantastic. Getting a very nice picture of the organization of the cerebellum that way. It's going to take a long time to cover the whole cerebellum.
I guess so.
Cerebellum is extremely extensive in its surface area, and only a small portion of it's out where you can see it.
Yeah.
They're all folded in the cerebellum is folded with many, many, many folds.
What about technological developments? I guess in 1958, Rose and Phil Davies came to Wisconsin with the microelectrodes.
That's right.
Was Joe Hind involved then at that point?
Yes, a group of us worked together. Joe was one. I worked with him. Wally Welker did. Let's see who else is on that list. Benjamin and Dick Thompson, who's now out in California. So that Welker picked up the method and then further refined it. So he developed some nice microelectrodes, which many people have been using since.
This added another dimension, I guess, to the studies that you've been involved with.
Yes, ours had been, we'd used a gross, what we call now a gross electrode. It might be a wire, say, a third of a millimeter in diameter, which looks kind of small under to the eye, you see. And we'd apply that to the surface of the brain every millimeter, perhaps even every half millimeter in some cases. But you see, that's only one electrode per square millimeter, where he's using 100 per square millimeter. So it's 100 times as refined. And of course, he's recording from single cells, whereas we recorded from a group of cells, whose activity could be sampled by the electrode on the surface of the brain. Because that's much finer than what the electroencephalographers do. They cover your head with on the scalp with electrodes, and they may be a centimeter in diameter. So they're not going to get anything very detailed the way you would with a microelectrode.
Well, these single unit recordings really give you almost a different kind of information about the functions of the nervous system, don't they?
They do. Welker showed, among other things, that if you will apply, say, one of these more gross electrodes, a three, a third of a millimeter electrode to a spot on the cortex, and record the skin area, which gives you responses when you stimulate the skin, and then use a microelectrode and explore this same region of the cortex in small steps, that the smaller electrode records from the same region of the skin, but a smaller portion of it. And if you will then map this cortex across the point which had the larger electrode on it, you'll find that as you move the cortex, the electrode, you move the portion of the, suppose the area that had been responded to the whole electrode included the whole hand.
Hmm.
Now when you start in one spot, you may find that now the response is limited to the thumb, another to a spot on the palm of the hand, another, say, to the index finger, and so on. So that what the larger electrode is doing is summating or adding together the activities established from this different part, because it can record from when you get a microelectrode, the resistance is high, and you're close to the cell which is producing the response, and you may get some signal of the responses that are remote, but they don't look, they're not single, they're not spikes like you get when you're right on the cell which is responding.
Hmm. It's more of a blurring.
It's a blurring.
So you have, with a microelectrode, you get a finer spatial resolution.
That's right.
And you also can get the time resolution of the
time resolution.
Firing of the individual neurons, which I guess is what Rose and Hind have tried to do with the hearing.
And then this is what you do with, and then of course this technique allows one to make close correlations with the structure of the brain from which you're recording. That's particularly striking when you get into the nuclei of the thalamus or elsewhere in the brainstem. But even in the cortex, you can see where the cells are situated, which are responding. And they're made to respond differently. And see, there are six layers to the cortex. And the response that you record with a microelectrode may vary depending upon which layer you're in. It may be much more restricted when you're in the area which tends to receive the information from the periphery, which is layer four, than if you're just above it or below it.
Hmm.
So that they can correlate the kinds of activity with the structure of the brain.
And this may be skipping ahead a little bit, but how did the advent of the computer end up affecting neurophysiology? I guess this would have been in the 60s, but...
Well, that, of course, had a tremendous effect. Before computers were had, if you were studying microelectrodes, you would put the electrode in the structure which is responding, and you would maybe photograph the response, get a picture of the nature of the discharge. But no matter how many times you photographed it, you'd only get a very few, maybe 50 or something like that, impulses. But with a computer, you can record from thousands, and you can use the computer to process the results and come up with analysis of the data in relation to time and locus and all sorts of things.
And save a lot of time.
Yeah. Let me get you something here, just a minute. Here's a short account by Joe Hind, which he just typed for this thing. This is something he spoke about in both in Algiers and in Shanghai. And this is called Digital Computer Applications in Neurophysiology. And he says, thanks to advances in solid-state electronics over the past two decades, digital computers have enjoyed a steady decline in the ratio of price to performance. As a result, computers have evolved from large computational devices found only in specialized computing centers to a broad continuum of machines, the smallest of which, the so-called microprocessors, are now commonplace in settings ranging from the research laboratory to the home. Computers have become virtually indispensable to many areas of experimental and theoretical neurobiology. In the laboratory, computers generate stimuli, analyze data with a degree of precision and speed that cannot otherwise be achieved. Most importantly, online usage, while an experiment is in progress, provides the basis for optimizing experimental strategy. An example is the use of adaptive techniques whereby the computer adjusts stimulus intensity in relation to some measure of neural response to achieve automated determination of a sensory threshold. To theoreticians, mathematical models and simulations offer means to test quantitative hypotheses and suggest critical measurements to their experimental colleagues. Hmm. And so, and he goes on to say more about it.
Do you think there's any truth to the worry that computers provide you with such an abundance of data and so much analysis and so forth that it's difficult to be sure that your interpretations are sound?
Well, I suppose people can misinterpret, but I don't think that's a reason for not using such devices to aid in the conduct of research. I think scientists have always made miscalculations, and that's what you keep on working for, is to correct the and expand the information that you've gotten from less satisfactory techniques. I think that, well, when you see what detailed results you can get from a very small portion of the brain, a single cell, let's say, and you realize that that's not the only cell which is responding to that particular stimulus, for example, if you're recording the results of a stimulation, but there are thousands of others. And ultimately, all that information has to be studied and all has to be put together to see how the thing is really working to produce the output from the nervous system. That's going to take generations. I've always said, if you come back 1,000 years from now to see what's going on, you will find that much has happened, but they still don't have the answer to all the questions which have been posed by the nervous system.
Seems like neuroscientists have a particularly difficult material they're trying to understand.
But I think I think so, but I think they're getting good data on the parts that they have been able to study, and I think this will continue, and I think in the long run somebody will have to put it all together to see what the whole machine is doing.
Are there any other obvious innovations or new techniques that in the years you've been here in Wisconsin that have helped in this field that you're familiar with?
Well, you already talked with Dr. Rose about the work that he and his wife are doing on it's her area, of course, primarily, this tissue culture technique. That's not a new technique, but it's new in its application to the ear. That was something new that she began, and it seems to be working very beautifully there. And they are trying to study electrophysiologically the events which are taking place in those tissue cultures. I haven't heard a report on that recently, but that's something you perhaps have talked over with him.
Was the trip that you made to John Lilly's lab in the early 50s, was that primarily a jaunt? I heard that it wasn't exactly a very fruitful trip.
Well, it was an interesting, the idea was an interesting one. He had He was working down in a lab. It wasn't his laboratory. It was the Marine Biological Laboratory, I think it was called, in Florida. I've even forgotten the name of the place where it was. It's the northern part of the east coast of Florida. And they were studying the porpoise. They had a number of them in enclosures. And John had been down there studying some of the behavior of these animals. And I don't now remember how it came about that the group of about 8 or 10 of us got together and went down. Joe Hind went from here with us. Jersey Rose was then at Hopkins. He came down. Mouse, from a neurosurgeon from New York, came down. Kruger, who's now in California, came. Seems to me that another man who was there was Carl Prebum from who's now at Stanford. And we had hoped that we would be able to do some electrophysiology of the brain of this animal. It had good facilities for laboratory facilities, and I think we took electronics equipment from Madison. The people from Baltimore brought some from there. I think Mountcastle was also in on that trip. And so we undertook to carry out some studies on the sensory systems of this particular animal. The thing we didn't know at the time, and nobody knew at the time, was that the effect that the Nembutal anesthesia was going to have upon the respiration of this animal. We expected he would be still able to breathe, but the mechanism, the muscular mechanism, which allows the animal to inhale, hold his breath while underwater for as long as a minute, and then come up and exhale, this mechanism was interfered with by the anesthetic, and it turned out that we just couldn't. We tried, I don't know how many animals, 2 or 3. And the main thing we got out of it was we got some electrocardiographic recordings. We studying the heartbeat while the animal was under anesthesia and before. And we got the brain specimens, of course. And so that the only research result of that expedition which led to anything was the anatomy of the brain, which Kruger studied under Jersey Rose's supervision back in Baltimore.
Hmm.
So that later, Wally Welker and one of our former fellows here, Dick Lendy, who became a neurosurgeon, returned to study of this animal. In the meantime, someone had developed a artificial respirator.
Hmm.
See, the trachea is about so big around.
About an inch?
Oh, it's, I'd say an inch and a half or two.
Hmm.
And it's only between the larynx and the beginning of the branching of the bronchial tubes, it's only another 2.5 inches or so. And so you have only a small portion in which you can insert a tube. If you do what we would do on patients, make a hole in the trachea in the neck. But they did that and succeeded in getting some data, which they subsequently published.
Hmm.
Okay, I don't know whether I have what's in here. No, it's not in here.
What about your work on some of the journals? I guess you were on editorial boards in Journal of Neurophysiology, I guess, and Physiological Reviews. Was that very extent? What did you have to do?
Well, you've got papers to look over and decide whether they are, whether they should be accepted, if they should be accepted, whether they should be accepted as prepared, or whether they needed some revision, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I did more of that for the Journal of Neurophysiology than for any other journal. In fact, while I was on the Physiological Reviews, there were, they don't get very many articles per year because they're long, and the main problem we had to do was to decide what things ought to be reviewed and then pick people, select people to ask to do it.
Okay, now.